Let me go ahead and introduce our speaker today. Dr. Phil Adler is Professor Emeritus, College of Management, Georgia Tech, 47 years, and retired Colonel, U.S. Air Force Reserve, 31 years. Dr. Phil taught management theory, personnel management, and systems theory, organizational design, research, and development, and public relations at Tech, and was Clinical Associate Professor of Rehabilitation Medicine at Emory. He also had a weekly radio program, Dr. Phil at Large, on 1620 AM, and previously was on WGST. I had the privilege of being on his radio program a couple times. Dr. Phil has served as advisor, consultant, and lecturer for the White House, Georgia's Office of the Governor, Department of Public Safety, and Department of Education, City of Atlanta, MARTA, Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, National Police and Fire Departments, and Academies, various business firms, medical groups, and nonprofits, CDC, and Journal of Business Research. His publications have appeared in various management, business, and medical journals and books, and the Atlanta Journal and Constitution. He also chaired the grievance process for Georgia Tech. Dr. Phil is a member of the American Legion, Military Officers Association, and Varsity O Club of The Ohio State University, where he received his PhD. He has received Annex Distinguished Professor Award, Alpha Kappa Psi's Outstanding Teacher Award, and was on the Technique's Top 10 Professor list at Georgia Tech. Dr. Phil moved to Atlanta from Cincinnati in 62 and lived in Sandy Springs before moving to Polo. And Dr. Phil has an extensive and very interesting background, so I've asked him to share some of that. He's very reluctant to do that because he doesn't like to talk about himself, but and to kind of give you an overview and then have a short time for Q&A if there's a specific area you'd like to have him maybe share in some more detail. So, Dr. Phil, if you're ready to go, let me put this in your pocket here.
It's great to be with friends, neighbors, and I'm wondering, before I introduce my wife, is there anyone that was here when I spoke about 3 or 4 years ago to this group? Anybody? Was it 10? Yeah. Was it 10? Was it that far back? Well, one thing I can say, no matter what, no matter where I go now, I'm the oldest person there. And I hate to say it, but I'm 88, so I've been around a while. So I'd like to introduce my wife, Sharzi. She can speak for herself better than I, but the reason that she is here, I know it's all men, but I don't drive anymore, and I live right across the golf course. I've lived here in Polo 14 years. I live over in Westchester, a little bit too far to walk, and I'm not driving anymore because I could have better vision than I've got right now. So Sharzi brought me in. One thing I might tell you before I start, she's quite a vocalist, and although she did not continue in the entertainment show business world, you can hear a 16-track CD of hers on YouTube, and it's pretty music. It's 50s romantic-type music. You don't hear that anymore, and I particularly like it because I used to do a lot of radio romantic music broadcasting, but if you look on YouTube, or go to Google and put in Google, YouTube, and then her name. And they move her around on Google YouTube all the time. Sharon in concert, her given name, or Sharzi Adler, her nickname, and my last name, of course. So anyway, good to have my wife here. It's good to have all of you friends, neighbors here as well. At any rate, what Hines is, and he's been my guest twice on radio, on my radio talk show. I'll tell you a little bit more about it in a little bit. But Hines asked me to review with those, with my friends, neighbors that are here today, my life. Well, I don't know it's worth reviewing, but that's not what Hines asked me to do. And he's my neighbor and great friend, and we both share a great love, as Sharzi and I did for Jesus, and Sharzi and I do, because we share a great love for Jesus Christ. And it's not a religious involvement that we have here today, but I can't help but say that, because Heinz has been very, very instrumental in my love for Jesus, so I leave it at that. Basically, I'd like to say this, what Heinz asked me to do, to review my life. Well, this is really going to always result in three words you're going to say: me, my, and I. And I don't like to say those, but Heinz, my friend, my neighbor, he asked me to share my life, so I said, okay, I will do it, and recognize that I know that my experiences in life are unique, but so are each of yours. So there is nothing to say that is that special about what I'm going to tell you, except it's me, and each of you are you. So we'll talk a little bit about the things that I've been involved with over my life, and maybe a little time left for Q&A, if I don't know that I want questions, because I may not have the answers. But at any rate, when I do it, talk anything like this, and it's not something I've often done, but I will review some things that I've lived, a lot of very different things, but I will do that. But I am always cognizant of the fact that I am who I am and you are who you are, and there is nothing to say that I'm any different or special than any one of you. And if I ever forget that, I think about something that I frequently have told audiences of mine for years that lets them know I know I'm no different than any one of them. And that is about two patients of a mental hospital that had some difficulty in their relationship, because the one was always saying he was Napoleon, I am Napoleon. And the other guy would say, I'm sick and tired of hearing you say you're Napoleon. You are not Napoleon. Don't ever say it again. You're not Napoleon. The other guy replied, do not challenge that. I am Napoleon. I am Napoleon. The other guy said, whoever told you you were Napoleon? And said, God told me I'm Napoleon. To which the other guy replied, I did not. So we can get involved in upmanship and whatever, but no great reason to do that. I was I'm a native of Cincinnati, Ohio, born and raised in Cincinnati. I've lived in Atlanta now since 1962 when I came to Georgia Tech. We'll get to that later. But at this point, let me tell you very quickly my early background. I was skinny. I'm still skinny, but I was even skinnier than now when I was very little. And I had golden blonde curls on my head, and I constantly would hear from other kids, hey, girly hair, girly hair, and they try to beat on me. Well, it was hard for me because I was skinny and they were bigger and heavier even of my own age, but I finally made up my mind there's a way to stop these jerks, and I said, I'll be ornerier the rest of my life, beginning now, than they could ever be. And so I developed my own little wrestling skills. Now, not at the level of my great student, Billy Seville here, who wrestled for Georgia Tech, but I developed a few that came in pretty handy later. And let me say this, I have failed to recognize not only Billy Seville, a great student of mine, a great executive of business in the area, but my friend John Arendt, who he and I have got to know each other through the American Legion, of which he is the former commander of half of Georgia of the American Legion. And I'm looking to see, I don't think any one of the other members of our group, except of course Heinz, that I have known before. Is there anyone I have known? I know one gentleman who we had something in common with. Where are you? Is it Jack? Did I?
Clarence Weaver.
Okay, great. And we have some mutual friends. But at any rate, I'm delighted to be here with you all today. I'm not an early morning person, so if I fall asleep while I'm talking, that'll just be you falling asleep. So, as I said, I was born and raised in Cincinnati, Ohio. Anybody that's ever been to Cincinnati in this group today that knows, okay, well, you may know where I'm talking about. I am the only person still alive that personally knew Barney Kroger, the founder of Kroger's. And he was, and he died in 1938. I was 8 years old. And the way that particularly I got to know him was my grandfather was his first meat cutter in his first store. It was in the 1880s. And as a result of that, my grandfather and father founded Adler Meat Company, and our business was right across the street. And the reason I ask anybody been to Cincinnati, right across the street from Barney's first store. And believe me, I didn't call him Barney. Mr. BK was the way he was known. We were within 30 seconds of his store, which was a problem for him. Because the minute I could be at, when I'm down at a family, Adler Meat Company, when I could get away, I ran over to his store, which was about 30 seconds across Broadway, which is a wide street down to the river from downtown Cincinnati. And why did I want to go there so much? And I was looking to see one of my suspenders backed off, it usually does. But he had a pickle barrel and a candy barrel out in front of his first store, like stores of that time in the 30s did. And I enjoyed getting into the candy and the pickle barrel, but he didn't enjoy having me there. And he used to call my father, grandfather, get that kid back to your place. And he didn't use the word kid. He was a lot stronger. So anyway, I knew him quite well. I was 8 years old when he died in 1938. Maybe I should have been in the grocery business, because although he disliked me, I was a brat to him, and I don't blame him. George Jenkins, who founded Publix, on the other hand, became a very good friend of mine in Miami, Florida, at his first store down there. And believe it or not, most people don't know it. The founder of Publix, George Jenkins, went to one college. He did not graduate, but he went to one college, and it was Georgia Tech. And very few people know that, but that's where the founder of Publix went to college. At any rate, I developed in terms of being able to withstand being called girly hair and developed my own attacks for that, and nothing pleased me more than when mothers of other kids would call my mother and say, your son hurt my son today. And oh, I said, that's wonderful. I was really now achieving what I wanted to do, and they left me alone. But I learned my own wrestling skills then. I developed them myself. They came in a little bit handy to me a little later life, I'll tell you about. In high school, I was a track guy. Skinny, fast, because I had no weight to carry. And I ran the 50, the 100, and 220-yard dash. Well, I went to a college prep school called Walnut Hills High School, if any of you ever heard of it, in Cincinnati. I wanted to go to Ohio State University. I had chances to go to other schools, but I wanted to go to Ohio State because I wanted to get a varsity O letter from Ohio State University. That would have made me a big deal, I felt. Well, I did get into Ohio State University, and interestingly enough, my end of my freshman year and the beginning of my sophomore year, an event took place that would shape a lot for me, but I went out for track at Ohio State University. Well, I was not out of the starting block, and the guy next to me was finished. He happened to be Mal Whitfield, the Olympic gold medalist in the quarter mile, and as a result, I knew, no, I ain't going to make this team. So I had fraternity brothers who were wrestlers, and my great student, Billy Seville, was a great wrestler for Georgia Tech. But I was not a great wrestler for Ohio State, but I did win a couple of varsity O letters, and I'm still proud of them. I don't know where I got them in this house, Charzy, but they're somewhere in our house. But anyway, I did go out for wrestling, and I wound up more a coach's helper than I wrestled, because I got pinned quite a bit, but once in a while I got somebody around my legs and I pinned them, but that was very rare. But at any rate, at Ohio State University, because of just the way I am, I guess, I had a couple of guys, well, about four, who were politicians on the campus. At that time, we were the largest university in enrollment in the United States, and each of, I don't know, around 20,000 students. It was quite big. That was in 50... 48 and 49. But there was a big interest in political things by me at that point, and I wanted to get involved in the political structure of Ohio State University. Well, these guys, a couple of them were veterans of World War II, and one of them was the Ohio State starting center on Ohio State's varsity football team, which is a big deal, obviously, at that university. And so they ran a campaign for me, and that got me elected president of the class of 52 of Ohio State University. Well, right before I was elected to that, these same guys promoted a girl that they wanted to have as homecoming queen. They promoted her well in the campaign. She was elected homecoming queen. Life magazine put her on the cover of a Life issue. Her picture was spotted by a man many of you have heard of called Howard Hughes. And he ultimately married this lady, Jean Peters, made her a famous movie star. You may have heard of her. But he and I got to know each other through her. So Howard Hughes, the famous gene, and he was a genius, eccentric as can be, but brilliant, brilliant. One of the great humans that have lived in recent times. His Spruce Goose airplane and things like that, Hughes Oil, Tool Company, everything, and a great producer and director of film, including that of his wife, Jean Peters. Well, this fit right in. Jean fit right in because from early age, I wanted to be a radio broadcaster. And I used to play around with it at home, where I grew up in my house with various phonographs and whatever, being a DJ. So it got me more and more interested in that area of the world. And then the entertainment field really got to me pretty strongly by the time I was getting near my final years in high school. And so I got a job at WLW in Cincinnati, the most powerful radio station that ever existed, 500,000 watts. And it drowned out everybody. And that's why throughout the world today, no station is stronger, as far as I know, than 50,000 watts. But I became a page there, a page in radio like politics and Congress. It's a gopher. That's what I was, a gopher. I did it. I even had sound, but did sound effects on the air, never spoke, but was a janitor. You name it, I did it, and I hosted visiting guests, anybody and everybody who wanted to be known in entertainment world at this particular point wanted to be heard on WLW. And I did programs and helped as a gopher, even with people like Orson Welles in The Shadow and programs like that. Anybody who was anything in radio at that time wanted to come and broadcast WLW, including Rosemary and Betty Clooney, who lived up the river in Kentucky, in northern Kentucky, and came over. And one time, or a couple more once, they brought their little brother. His name was David Clooney. David happens to be in a situation where I wound up as a gopher of the station taking care of David. Well, I was 15 at that time. David was 10, 5 years younger than me. I assume he still is. David is the father of the heartthrob of all women, George Clooney. So I took care of George's daddy when he was a little boy. And I know a lot of women would envy just the fact that I knew George's dad, but I never knew George, who spent a lot of time in northern Kentucky across the river from Cincinnati. I think he went to Northern Kentucky University, in fact. But as all of you know, he's quite the heartthrob of women today. But at any rate, I graduated from Ohio State University. I had my different things that I was involved with. I was president of that class and so forth. So the other big thing that I felt I did at Ohio State was to get involved with wrestling, and I told you about that. I was the worst wrestler in the history of collegiate wrestling, but I got my varsity of letters, and that is what counted. And then my other big thing there, other quite big, at Land-Grant University, Ohio State, was I had to take basic ROTC. Well, at that time, they divided us into two groups. The first half of the alphabet went Air Force ROTC, Air Corps. It was Army Air Corps still. The other half went Army. And I didn't know my right foot from my left foot. I'd once fired a small .22 rifle at a camp. My parents wanted to get rid of me, and I don't blame them, every summer. And they'd send me up to northern Wisconsin with a Lakota Sioux Indian, another great thing in my life, because he and I became a blood brothers. I have American Indian blood in me, Lakota Sioux. I'm very proud of that. So at any rate, I was not military. I knew nothing really about it other than kids play soldier or something, and I had soldiers and that kind of thing as a kid. But during the middle day years of the Second World War, a troop train came through Cincinnati, and my dad knew and found out, my whole family at home, my mother, whatever, that I had a cousin who was going to be in charge as a lieutenant in charge of that troop train. I went down with my dad to see him and meet him, and I saw him in uniform as a lieutenant, U.S. Army, and I wanted to be a U.S. soldier no matter what. And nothing more important to me in my life, my wife will tell you and others know as well, I retired a colonel of U.S. Air Force, and anything else ever I did was irrelevant compared to being a U.S. military officer. I am so proud that I was able to do that and do what I could for my country, and I had 40 years U.S. Air Force, 31 active. Of course, I was a reserve, but a lot of active duty, but during the Korean War, quite a bit of active duty. So I have a lot of military experience, and I got it as a result, beginning from ROTC. I was in the first Air Force ROTC class of 49. We had just become a separate branch of the Department of the U.S. Department of Defense. To then, we were U.S. Army Air Corps, which was certainly a proud thing in itself, but we became U.S. Air Force, and I was in the first ROTC class to go as Second Lieutenant, United States Air Force. And I graduated a distinguished military grad, even though when I started, I was the most unsoldier person you would ever know. But because of that, they offered me a regular commission. I don't like to move. And if you're active duty military, I'm talking to John. I'm looking right at John. He's American Legion with me. He's a soldier, too. I didn't want to move. So I took the reserve commission, and I was active reserve 31 years, as I said, 10 more beyond that is inactive reserve, and then total of 40, and then they retired me. They wanted to get rid of me. I'd hoped to make Brigadier General. I didn't, because I lost my aeronautical rating because I was observer, a tech observer, and that was no longer given wings to wear. So with that rating loss, I could not get higher than Bird. I wanted to be a Brig BG, but I couldn't make it, didn't have that rating, and didn't qualify probably in a lot of other ways. But at any rate, it all started with Air Force ROTC at Ohio State University. Because I'd been distinguished military grad, they gave me a good assignment at when I went on active duty, and it was Headquarters Air Research and Development Command. It was one of the first uses of the words research and development. You hear it now all the time, but as far as I know, that might have been the earliest use of it. And that was station headquarters, Air Research Development Command in Baltimore. One thing about that I particularly remember, the mayor of Baltimore at that time, D'Alessandro, had a daughter. And she was a little girl, and we would go down there. I would see her there. At lunch, we'd go because he gave people in uniform at that restaurant. I don't know if he was the only owner, but he was involved in ownership, the mayor of Baltimore. He gave us a good deal at lunch. So we would go down there, and right now I can't think of her name. She's now Speaker of the House again. She was before Bonner, who was also from Cincinnati, who was Speaker, and he left now, and she is the Speaker of the House. What is her name? Billy? Who's the Speaker of the House right now? Or Hines, anybody? What is her name? Pelosi. Yeah, that's Alessandra's daughter. So I knew her as a little girl, but and it's something that I kind of remember when you see people that you knew when they're younger and they grow up and they're significant in the world. Certainly she is. So anyway, that I had a very interesting time, and I was involved in the whole time, everything for me, Air Force combat support. I was involved in flight tests of aircraft and armament of the aircraft, bombs to be dropped, guns to be fired in the air, and then missiles. I got involved in the development of pretty heavily involved in the development of missile testing range from Cape Canaveral. Now it's all NASA, but at those times it was Army field artillery. I got involved in converting that and making that into the missile test range. It went into the Bahamas, so forth. So I was into that, but also aircraft flight tests and armament of the aircraft of various kinds. I had great opportunity to meet a lot of great military people, and I worked up through the ranks later on, and I had the chance to meet some great, great American patriots. And one of them you may have heard of, and I got to know him well and named my youngest son after him. You may have heard of, I hope you have, Omar Bradley, one of the five-star generals of the United States Army. He was Eisenhower's deputy and one of the five-star, like Eisenhower, MacArthur, Arnold, and so forth. And I got to meet him up at the National War College when I went there for a course at Fort McNair in Washington. He was playing tennis when I was off from time for lunch and got to watch him and meet him. But one of the great men I have ever met, maybe in many ways the greatest, although I'm sitting here with Billy and Heinz and John, great people too. But Omar Bradley, he led the entire campaign in Europe as Eisenhower's deputy. And I'll tell you where you'll see a little bit about him. If you ever see the movie Patton, Patton reported to him. He was Patton's boss, was Omar Bradley. But I've got to meet people like that. Earl Partridge commanded all of the forces for the U.S. in the Korean era, for the Korean area for a while. He was primarily Air Force. But my military career is very, very important to me, and I consider myself a soldier. No more than anything else, I am a soldier. And for the United States, there is no greater honor, I think, a human man can have to be a soldier of the United States. So at any rate, that was my military and brief. Ultimately, I became a full colonel. I had, before that, after I got off active duty, my reserve time was research and development, where I was now at Georgia Tech. I'll tell you about that very shortly. But you can't do much R&D work when you're a college professor. You're not in my field. I needed to be around the Flight Test Center at Edwards Air Base or Eglin Field or Patrick, White Sands. So these were the kind of things that I was used to. Special weapons, I don't talk about it. I can't. But I was involved in a great deal of that kind of military activity. Thing that I found about, I couldn't continue as I move up the ranks in research and development. It fit what my specialty, the professional specialty of a civilian, but there was nothing that I could do in the military. So they transferred me to specialty in air police, and particularly anti-terrorism, and up to the rank through lieutenant colonel. I did a lot of work in anti-terrorism, particularly to protect our military industrial facilities, of which Lockheed was one of mine. Ultimately, I got an office at Lockheed as I became the commander for the Southeast region when I got colonel as commander for the Southeast region. At that time, Defense Supply Agency, today I think it's called Defense Logistics Agency. I had quite an interesting command. I had billions of dollars and thousands of people under me in the Southeast U.S. connected with U.S. defense and with our military and industrial military complex. But that was my military career in that regard, and I'm very proud and I'm still involved with it. And My wife, she's now very much Air Force, and we live U.S. Air Force in so many ways. In fact, we're going out to Dobbins today. She loves the PX. That is a problem. She loves the PX. But the other major part of my life, then there are major parts. Being I was interested in radio, when I was in graduate school, I got really involved in radio, much more so than a gopher. I got on the air. I had done a little bit of air time before then. But I went to the University of Miami for my master's degree. I didn't even know what a master's degree was until I got on active duty and heard in military during the Korean War. The guy said they were going for a master's. I said, what is that? So I found out I happened to have an uncle who was on the adjunct faculty at the University of Miami, Florida. And that wound up being rather instrumental to me in many ways, because during my military activity, I had some naval time on an aircraft carrier where I met some Royal Navy officers. We had joint research and development activity. And I was all ready to get off active duty and then go to Scotland and become a member of the Black Watch, that Scottish Brigade of fame of the British Army. I just wanted to do that, but I got this opportunity to go to Miami as on a fellowship. I had the GI Bill available. I had this fellowship scholarship, so I was teaching down there. And through my teaching there, I had some students in my class who were, being Miami, who were connected to wealth and show business. So I wound up, through them, getting to know a number of people, several of them famous from Hollywood. I'd already known Gene Peters, but that was a different story, as I told you. So I got to know a number of prominent Hollywood actors and actresses and race car drivers, who particularly were great friends of mine. Lance Revenlow, who was Barbara Hutton's son. Barbara Hutton was the heir of the Woolworth fortune heir. And Peter Revson, who was Revlon. His grandfather was the founder of Revlon. Both of those men were killed racing, as I remember, a car called a Scarab in Grand Bahama races, and they were great friends of mine. But in those kind of people, I was meeting actors and actresses and running around, going around with people like that. Required money. Well, the only money I had, GI Bill and what the University of Miami was paying me for teaching and whatever else, so I needed work. I needed something else. I didn't want to be a store clerk. I didn't think that would fit me. That's great for some people, and we all love our store clerks. We couldn't even buy half of what we buy without retail store clerks. But I wanted something different. I wanted to get back into the show business world that I had gotten some involvement with. And during my military time, and right after, after I got off active duty, after the Korean War, a very active reserve, but not 24/7, I went to work for Westinghouse as an industrial engineer at the Air Electronics Armament Plant in Baltimore, Maryland, and met a girl there. She worked for WBAL, a TV station in Baltimore. Had a sister who was very active in the New York theatrical world of off-Broadway. And my buddy here, my great student, Billy Seville, has a daughter who's an actress now and probably knows more about what I'm talking about than I would know. But anyway, I got involved because of her in being an assistant producer off-Broadway in New York City. And I lost every dime I put into the productions I was involved with, which figures, because I didn't know what I was doing. But it was kind of fun. But it really got me into show business big time. But at any rate, then when I went to Miami, I needed a job. I called and I went down cold to one of the radio stations there and asked if they needed anybody on their staff as an announcer. And they looked at me. I finally got to see the general manager. Who are you, and why do you want to do this? Well, I need money, and I want to be in radio. So ultimately, they hired me, and I did romantic request music. Late night, you can request romantic music for your loved one. So So I did that, and that really got me big time radio down there. And before long, I was hosting major shows at some of the big hotels down there. So I had that big question. I was also what they called it those days, a crooner. And today I can't hold a note, but my wife can. I can't. But I had to decide, do I want to go and be a Perry Como or somebody like that, you know? But no, I didn't think I was that talented, and I'm sure other people didn't either, so I didn't do that. What did I want to do then? Did I want to be a radio broadcaster the rest of my life? Well, I wanted to, but ratings. Every day you fear your ratings are down, you lose your job. I said, nope. I said, there's a good thing about being a college instructor. You can set your own hours, and you don't have to be at work every day at 8 o'clock or earlier. Well, I found out quite differently when I came to Georgia Tech, because Billy, as you know, we have classes all over the block and over the schedule, and I got some of those, 8 o'clock in the morning, 6 days a week, as a matter of fact. But at Miami, I got some very fine education in the field of business, which was my basic area. And after completing my master's degree, and I did my master's thesis on impact of the Orange Bowl on Miami, and I did work for the Orange Bowl. I was radio. I was having a good time, but I needed to think to the future, and I did a little bit, and I thought, okay, I better, and they told me, you're not going to stay here without a doctorate degree. If you want to be a professor here at the University of Miami, they called it Sun Tan U then. It was a great school then, and it's even greater today. Some of its fields are at the very top. You need any eye surgery or what, you can't do better than anyone from University of Miami Med School, Law School. It's the business school, great university, and I'm proud of my MBA from there. Taught there 5 years, but I knew I needed to get the PhD, and I went back to Ohio State and became a PhD student there, taught there. Had some rather infamous students as a graduate instructor, assistant instructor was my title. Jack Nicklaus was my student. He wouldn't remember me from day one. Why? Girls and golf were far more important to him. By the way, his father was the pharmacist and owner of Nicklaus Drugs, which was on the campus, and I knew his daddy. I remember Nick Jackie when I was a little boy because I'd been in his dad's store. Right next to his Jack Nicklaus's father was another store that I went to on the other end of the campus from me, and that store was owned by a gentleman you may have heard of, Dave Thomas. It was a KFC, and Dave Thomas was the owner. Dave was, I think he was either an orphan, a foster child. He had a lot of sympathy for people who had no money. And we grad students, med students, and people like me, we had no money. The GI Bill ran out for me pretty quickly, and so I would get a ride over. I didn't have a car up there with me at that time. I'd ride over to his KFC, and like the med students and other graduate students like me, we would eat on credit. And it was funny. We'd see each other there twice a month when we were paying our credit to Dave. And ultimately, Dave was found by some man with wealth who set him up in a hamburger business on the road down from that area to the airport, Port Columbus. And today, you know that business is Wendy's. And Wendy, I remember his little girl Wendy running around when I would go there to eat on credit till I got some money. So, and of course, hamburger went from chicken to hamburger. But Dave was quite successful and very helpful to people like me. He gave us credit when we didn't have money to eat. So, at any rate, that was something then that took place at Ohio State University. And I did wind up getting my degree, my PhD there, and then there was the question of what would I do. And so, like any other new PhD, our basic profession lies ahead, for the most part, either research or being a professor alone, teaching and research. Well, there were various job opportunities that I had offered, and it came down to whether I would go to Michigan State or come to Georgia Tech. And Tech had interest in me, brought me down here, and for an interview, I stayed at the Biltmore Hotel. which was quite the place to stay, huge rooms and whatever else, but they didn't have a spot for me. Well, about 2 months later, they called me and said, we had just retired a professor, and I found out that he was retired for mental instability. So they were getting rid of one nut, and they wanted to hire another one. That was me. So they hired me in 1962. At that time, we were the School of Industrial Management, and I joined the faculty of Georgia Tech as an assistant professor of industrial management. Probably about a year or two later, 63, 64, for some, it was a complex thing, but because of military experience, CDC, Center for Disease Control, over on the Emory campus, as you know where, most of you know where it is, hired me as their chief lab advisor to the director of CDC, Dave Sensor, and later Jim Goddard, who became Surgeon General of the U.S. I was the prime safety advisor because of background I'd had from the military, prime safety advisor, director of CDC. And it was only about a year or two later after that Emory Medical School Dean heard about me and decided he might need, well, at the Emory Med School, someone who could help with medical safety at the med school, and including the Emory Hospital. So what came as a result of that, complex negotiations between the presidents of Emory University and Georgia Tech. We only had an acting president then. It was between regular presidents. They worked the first joint appointment ever between Georgia Tech and Emory. And as far as I know, there was not one before, but for sure to the med school. And I was appointed a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Emory School of Medicine, and they sent a bioengineer to Georgia Tech. Today, the collaboration between Emory and Georgia Tech in particularly the health medical area is phenomenal. But that was the beginning of it when I went to Emory. I was a medical school professor there for 26 years. But once the dean found me there, as well as Georgia Tech 56, Emory Medical 26 of those, once they found me, got me over there, they assigned me to the Department of Rehab Medicine. They had a slot there, and probably the most one of the Nobel Prize nominees, John Basmajian, who was co-author of the greatest book ever written in anatomy, and medical students have to study it everywhere in the world. John came there and to that same department, and the dean and others in administration of the med school quickly found out that I had a lot of interest and research done in systems. It's always seen as computer. Mm-hmm. Computers use systems thinking, but they do not. It's not exclusive to them. It's the interaction of things. And before long, I was doing research and teaching primarily to upper-class medical students, not the young ones, but teaching systems thinking for developing their diagnostic abilities and so forth. So
We need about three of these to cover your story. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, so Georgia Tech, isn't it amazing? But let me ask you to kind of conclude on this.
Okay.
Quickly, how you got to Georgia Tech, and then your primary teaching methodology that made people like Billy apply your principles and become successful. So those two things.
Okay. Well, at Tech, the College of Industrial Management, I was teaching concurrently and doing research at Georgia Tech and moving up the ranks to become full professor. Ultimately, the chair, the only chair of industrial management, and endowed by Marietta Chevrolet, the Smith family.
And they named the building after you, right?
Well, my name is on the building. Yeah, at the across from the Biltmore Hotel. It's up there. You can see it from the street and the window, or across the window up there at the fourth top floor of the building. It's now called the School of Business, College of Business. No longer College of Industrial Management. But my whole teaching methodology was built on a methodology developed by Socrates in the famous philosopher of ancient times, where the student learns by questions that the professor, the teacher, asks. On the basis of knowledge previously gained through that professor, through that teacher, they have a knowledge base where they can now jump to answer questions of things they've never experienced before. Because as I've always taught, and Billy will tell you, every single thing, every instant we live, we face a new situation, something new. But the more pieces we break it down through our analytic abilities, which I tried to teach, we see things that are similar in pieces to situations we've been in before, and we don't have to jump. The more we know of that, the further, less far we have to jump to understand the situation at that instant. It may be you've got a microsecond to decide how you're going to turn that wheel in a skid on an automobile, or how you'll handle a customer for a microsecond, or an employee, or whatever it is. So these are the kind of things that, as Billy heard me say many times, to teach you to make very, very prompt, quick, accurate decisions and take the action of that decision in a very, very brief time. And I put a lot of pressure on the students to develop that ability, and whatever Billy knows, maybe I've had a small piece of it, but Billy is an executive of a major bank, Regions. He could do it all, and he always would be able to do it all, and maybe I had a small part in developing that. I've had a lot of students who've done very well in spite of me. They've been from everything from military to every kind of industrial firm, people like Tom Fanning, the CEO of Southern Company, people like that, a minister who married us very recently right here, who is the head pastor of First Baptist of Lawrenceville, Inman Houston, whatever all walks of life can gain from the Socratic method. I had a lot of it taught to me. I learned it well, primarily at Ohio State, but a man who taught it, who gave me the best insight to it, T.N. Beckman, it's the word wholesaling is his word. So when he wrote his doctoral dissertation in the early 20s. So as a result of that methodology of teaching, that was where I went through in my teaching career, and people like Billy here had to endure it, but hopefully it paid off in some way. And so this was my basic thing in terms of what I did. And at the med school, it was more of the same, more research maybe.
One question. Who's got a question?
Where do you start?
I know, yeah.
What fraternity were you in?
What fraternity?
Phi Delta Theta. Many of you may have heard of it. I was their advisor at Georgia Tech for, well over 40 years. But this was Georgia Tech. A lot of things I was involved, but I want to tell one story everybody here may enjoy that at Georgia Tech. And that was that I had done as a varsity letterman at Ohio State recruiting. And they use their varsity letter people to help coaches recruit, particularly in football. And people like Hopalong Cassidy, you may have heard that name, Vic Janowitz, who was one of my roommates, in fact, who later was a catcher for Pittsburgh Pirates. They those kinds of activity gave me, and I did it even at the University of Miami for Andy Gustafson, head football coach there, recruiting. And I enjoyed it for all sports, women and men's, and did it at Georgia Tech. And then when I got to Tech, I guess I'd been there about 2-3 months, and I thought, well, I'd like to recruit for Tech and mainly start at football. So we had a very famous head coach at that time. His name was Bobby Dodd. So I decided, well, what to lose? I went down after class one day down to the athletic department offices in the old gym there, and asked the secretary if I could see Coach Dodd. Yeah, she gave me a bit of a hard time why I wanted to see him, and I told her I wanted to help in recruiting and whatever. She said, what? Well, I got her to finally ask Coach Dodd, who went to his office, opened the door, and asked him if I might be able to see him. And She said, okay, he's going to see you, but he's very busy. He's got a game coming up and whatever, but he'll give you a few minutes. I walked into his office, and Coach Dodd said, he called me son. He and I became very close. But he called, I think, most of his football players son. Maybe he didn't remember their names or what, but I was son. And basically, he said, I hear you want to see me about recruiting. Well, tell me about it. I don't have a lot of time, but tell me right now, what about? I said, well, Coach, I've done recruiting at Ohio State. Before that, University of Miami, particularly for football, but all sports, including women's. And I'm wondering if I could do something for you. He said, well, tell me a little bit of your experience in recruiting. I did, a few, 2 or 3 minutes. And he said, well, I'm told now, and you said that you've just come from Ohio State. You're a brand-new professor here, and that you were a varsity letterman there in student-athlete and wrestling, and that you want to do recruiting now, and you're an Ohio State undergrad PhD, and you want to recruit for me. How do I know you won't send the recruits I'd have you talk to Ohio State instead? I said, it's very simple, Coach Dodd. Look at the name at the top of my paycheck, Georgia Institute of Technology. He says, son, you come down here this Saturday. I got 21 recruits coming. And Bobby Dodd and I became very close. His granddaughter, in fact, was a student assistant of mine. But there are many things down there now that I look at. The gates are for parking. I was the president's chair for parking and things like that. All kinds of things. I set up his grievance committee for staff, committed staff members of the workforce of Georgia Tech, many, many different things, and coaches, you know, all the coaches. You can look up, if you want to see any more on that, look up the Georgia Tech Athletic Administration, and you'll see I was involved there. But you name it, a medical school at Emory and Georgia Tech and whatever, and I will just say very quickly, I've had the great opportunity of wives. My first wife, we were married 40 years, Donna, and I met her at Georgia Tech. Well, I knew her only for 2 months before we got married. I needed a doctoral dissertation typist. She met every need I had. We got married on April the 1st. I'd met her on February 28th of 1966, and we have 3 sons. One is a Motorola, one is a computer guy, and one is an attorney, a managing associate partner of a national law firm. So she lived 40, we were married 40 years. She died of breast cancer. I married another lady, and she was a manager of the Kroger store up here at 20 and 9, Lakewood, or whatever they call that. And that store is was closed. They transferred to be the manager up at exit 17 on 400, Super Kroger. She died last January of heart attack and smoking, unfortunately. If you smoke, you're going to die. It's not when, it's not if, it's when. And then very recently, I met this wonderful lady, Sharzi, and we met her on May 12th, and we got married in December. And I'm gifted again by Jesus God to have a wonderful wife, and you see her here today. Wonderful. So that is my life to a degree, and you see different things.
One last question. What is one short life lesson you would tell to the youth today? Just one quick sentence.
There's always something to learn, and everything you will ever face will be different by the microsecond than anything exactly you've ever faced before. And by the way, while I'm answering that, Heinz was a great guest of mine. I've been in radio all my life since I've been very, very young, as I told you, and my program here for 14 years, the last 14, were America's Web Radio, where I had broadcast all over the world, and I had a lot of listeners right here in Forsyth County. But that is another era of mine. I'm not on the air right now, but I still would love to be if the right opportunity came along, because radio is another thing I care a lot about. Heinz, that's it.
Thank you.
Anybody that's got any questions or whatever, I'm here.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.
Let me can I just tell this group, take two more minutes to tell them something? Well, I'll take a minute and a half.
Okay, go ahead. Minute and a half.
You know, one of the areas I've worked in is transportation. My doctoral dissertation was on the issues created for staffing locomotives in the dieselization period. And I did a lot of research in my in that, and that's my dissertation of the doctoral program at Ohio State. And it basically was manning, how to staff and man diesel locomotives compared to steam. And I was always quite interested in railroading. And this and airlines. I was a consultant to Lufthansa Airlines and America and Delta. I've had a lot of connection with, but railroading is particularly of interest. Always has been and will to me. And I want to tell you a little story real quickly in my probably extra half minute about railroading. All of you probably have had some experience with railroading, but no more job is important in railroading than the dispatcher. The dispatcher is the person who determines what track a train will be on and on what schedule. It's a matter of railroad basic operations to keep customers and safety. And so no more important job than the dispatcher to a railroad. A personnel guy was out trying to recruit new young people who could be trained to become railroad dispatchers. So he had one recruit before him, and he gave him the typical story to see how they would react and if there were potential to be a dispatcher. And he gave him this situation. The personnel guy, the hiring guy, said, I want to give you this situation. There are two trains on the same track heading for each other. They are now 4 miles apart, and they're both at speeds of approximately 70 miles per hour. How would you handle that? What would you do? And the guy says, well, I would run home and get my brother. And the personnel guy says, at a critical situation like this, you go home and get your brother? Why would you do that? He says, well, my brother ain't never seen a train wreck. Let me close with one more story.
Okay.
This is it.
Okay.
This is it. I just because
if
I
you have some place to go, feel free. But
I feel
Dr. Phil
free
will
to go.
Be here afterwards.
Hear this though. How many of you are fishermen? How many of you fish? I bet a number of you. Well, you know this. I always end by saying, whenever I speak to anybody, any groups, I say recognize in the end, and I started this way tonight, today too, we're all in the same boat one way or another. We all face challenges, and we all have to overcome them. And to remember what I'm saying about that, plus what I told you, we're all human, we all make the same errors, we all have the same types of problems, different, exacting, but always something along the same line. Two men were out, two friends out fishing on a lake. And one was named Ben, one was named Jim. And Jim says to Ben, you know, it's getting kind of dark out. I think we better go take this rental boat back into the dock now. And you know, we agree, Ben, this is the best fishing we've ever had on this lake. How about, Ben, would you mark this spot so when we come back, we'll know exactly where the best fishing is on this lake? And Ben says, Jim, sure, I'll do that right now. They get back to the dock with their rental boat, and Jim says, Ben, did you mark that great fishing spot? And Ben says, sure did. Well, how'd you do it, Ben? Ben says, I put an X on the side of the boat. And Jim says, Ben, that's how you mark that great fishing spot? Why, you dummy. How do you know we'll get the same boat tomorrow? Thanks for your attention.
Awesome.
Great
Thank
to be
you.
With you.
Thank you. Thank you. What an amazing story, and I'm sorry I cut it short, but I'm involved in a couple things that helped me reflect on my life. One is a group called My Story, and it's a friend of mine at another church, a small group. The purpose is to write a book on your life for your kids and your grandkids. And it's a fascinating effort because it, as you go back and you unravel your life, you see it's an amazing adventure, you know. And to put that down on paper really enriches your life and the life of your family. The other thing I've been asked to do is
give a talk on the early technology in Atlanta. And the same thing, I've been in the high-tech area here since 72. That's Phil was just a young boy then, but and it's the same thing. As you go back and you recall the events of your life that you've been at, you really see what an adventure this is. And so I encourage you to do that, and grateful to Dr. Adler to speak today, and that we have it on tape, because you can probably enjoy listening to this and hearing again his amazing life. So thank you for attending. Next meeting will be in May. Greg Dolezal will be our speaker. By the way, this is open to anybody in the Atlanta area, so it's not just the Polo, so feel free to invite your neighbors that live in other areas close by here. Thanks for coming, and have a great day. Thank you.